Doom Patrol, Negative Man, Elastigirl, Robot Man.
Someone wants the Doom Patrol reunited.
Your every word and action
is being broadcast across the planet.
Now, Monsieur Mana!
Well done, my Doom Patrol. Well done.
It is too late for you, Calder. Your beloved patrol is doomed.
Hello and welcome to Waiting for Doom, the Doom Patrol podcast, where we're waiting for the Doom Patrol comic to return from its Volume 5 hiatus with Volume 6.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Hello, I'm Mike. You can find me on Twitter at AvantGarve. You can reach us at waitingfordoom@gmail.com. You can reach us also via mygratitudeadventure80.blogspot.com, which is run by friend of the show, Doug Savisha. You can also find us on the Waiting for Doom Facebook page, and all our episodes are available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and Podbean.com.
And we're in computers all over the place.
Well, Wilfred is.
Yeah. Wilfred's in your smart device looking at you right now.
That's right. Ooh.
I'm Paul. You can find me on Twitter at @reading_Hicks. And Wilfred, who we mentioned before, is our Sentient Show Twitter account. And he's at WFDpod if you want to talk to Wilfred. He may want to talk to you. He's pretty fussy. And we are sponsored by Comicosity, the comic news website, which is very, very good for comic news and information and reviews and opinions and celebrating all things comic.
That's right. For example, this week, Matt Santori-Griffith has an interview with Rob Williams and Philip Tant about the Suicide Squad rebirth.
And yeah, I read that one. That was great.
It actually sounds pretty... I'm not a huge... squad fan, such as some people like yourself are, Paul, but like I'm keen to see the movie, obviously, and it's nicely timed on DC's part that the book is getting relaunched as part of Rebirth just before the film comes out this week.
Running off to the film this week?
I will hopefully be seeing the film in two nights' time, so I guess opening night here in Australia. Fingers crossed that I'm able to organize seats. What about you? How soon are you planning on seeing it?
Fingers crossed for Thursday night as well. Yeah. You know.
But yeah, it's nice to read that Tan and Williams are bringing Rick Flagg back into the DCU, and you know they're giving Amanda Waller a bit more of her, I guess you'd call it her classic look, where she's more the Wall, not you know the scrawny young thing.
Yeah, and they had a bit of props for the John Ostrander run, which is what I need to hear as a Doom Patrol fan.
Right.
I mean, a Suicide Squad fan.
I feel you. I get you. But yeah, that was a really cool interview. So yeah, check that out on comicosity.com.
Awesome. So, Mike, how was your week in comics?
I actually read some comics this week, Paul.
Wow.
A whole... Guess how many?
17.
Close? 2.
That would have been my next guess.
Yeah. Oh, so close. Issues, I think it was 7 and 8 of The Mighty Thor, where it's sort of, she's building up against the forces of evil in the other realms and, you know, trying to keep her civilian life as Jane Foster under wraps as well. And yeah, so that was cool. Yeah. So I've only got 20 left in my comic pile, in my pile of floppies, single issues to get through.
I think I've got every single issue of Mighty Thor to read and the previous series of Thor, and I haven't read any of them.
Oh.
It's all in digital copies. But
I highly recommend them. Reading the previous series as well before Jane takes over. Spoiler warning for those who don't know what's going on. Thor's a woman now. There you go. But yeah, other than that, just life as usual, you know, getting excited about reading some classic Doom Patrol this week and very minimal in the way of modern day comics. So yeah, how about yourself?
I've been doing the rounds of podcasts around the place. Wilfred's been pimping me out and giving me a percentage.
Finally, bringing some money in for us.
Yeah, so recently I've done the Task Force X podcast and I talked about the JLI Suicide Squad crossover from the 80s, with Aaron Headmoss. So go and check that out at Task Force X if you're interested. Mm-hmm. I did DC versus Marvel, which is a little podcast run by FKA Jason and Roy Cleary over at the Silver and Gold Network, mm-hmm. Where they pit a DC character against a Marvel character, and it's all random, and you have to say who would win. And
you didn't even know who you'd be discussing until you were on the show?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Wow. So, yeah.
Can you give us any spoilers?
I think Marvel won.
Ooh.
I'm not happy about that, but yeah.
Yeah, wow. Okay.
The randomizer is a blessing and a curse because it makes it random, but it also makes it like frustratingly obscure sometimes. But that's a fun little podcast. If you want to try a little short podcast, it's only about 12 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah. And I also did Secret Origins and I talked about Hawk and Dove. So the very
geez.
Yeah, and I did that with Dr. Ange. Me and Dr. Ange, we teamed up,
mm-hmm.
And we fought at first, and then no, we didn't. we got on well. Ryan, who runs that podcast, hates Hawk and Dove. So
does he really?
Yeah, Ange and I had to sort of try and make him see the good things about Hawk and Dove, and I don't think we succeeded at all.
Can you, without, you know, spoiling the entire episode, can you give us a hint as to why Ryan hates Hawk and Dove?
Oh, I just hate good stuff.
Right, the same way that you and I would think that anyone who doesn't like the Doom Patrol hates good stuff too.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Either that or it could be brain damage, I don't know.
Wow.
Hi, Ryan.
Wow. Holy jeez. Look, I think you better make your escape, and I think you better head down on Derrington Way, mister.
Oh, timely. Thank you. Okay, when we go down on Derrington Way this week, we see that there's been all sorts of sniggering by Mike in the background. Oh. There's variant covers. All the variant covers have been released.
Yes.
It's very
exciting.
Oh. So we've seen the Sanford Green one, which is a close-up of the team. We've seen the Jaime Hernandez one, which is the sort of side shot of some of the team. Mm-hmm. The Brian Bolland one, which has Cliff's brain and his skull and two ladies.
Yes.
And that's Casey Brink, the EMT, and the unknown lady, who we have seen in a few covers now.
Mm-hmm.
And been speculating. There's the Brian Chippendale, which is the painting in Paris after it sort of melted.
Yep.
It's a very interesting cover. The more I look at it, the more interested I am in that one.
Mm-hmm.
A Babs Tarr did one, which was sort of set in a video game parlor.
I love the Babs Tarr one.
That was, yeah, very, very purple, that
yes,
one.
Yes.
They're very good. And we've got the regular gyro cover with the sticker where we don't know what's under the sticker. What is under the sticker? Who knows?
Mm. We'll know soon.
And it's little details trickling out everywhere. So we know that the other EMT, the black guy who's the EMT, he is called Sam Reynolds.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I think we can confirm now that the cat is called Lotion the Cat.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a pretty common name there. So thought that'd be something imaginative. But anyway, now Nick Derrington is constantly tweeting out little pictures of line art that he's doing and blue pencil, and his editor Jamie Rich must be very happy that he's always seems to be working on the Doom Patrol.
Mm.
Mm. And there was an interview on Newsarama today, which gave us a few more details. So Jared Way was asked, what are your plans for the Doom Patrol as an ongoing story? Are they superheroes, something else? And he says, I see Doom Patrol as this really big network of people that are outsiders. I can't give away much, but after the first arc, I hate using terms like setup because the whole thing isn't set up. It's establishing things, but stuff happens. So by the time the team is fully formed, I wanted things to get really super strange. But once we've established our core, we get super effing weird. That's the idea. And later on, he talks about what he's bringing into the issue, and he says the influences and what he's bringing in. So aside from Grant, you had Rachel Pollack writing Doom Patrol. You had Arnold Drake's original 60s stuff. You had John Arcudi, John Byrne, Keith Given. They all did something different. I tried to see how I could take bits of what everyone did and put it in the book. In that first issue, there are references to Grant Morrison and Keith Given. So, that's exciting, isn't it?
Yes.
You and I have been speculating about one of the characters that we can see in some of the pictures.
We have indeed, sir.
Mm. Yes. So there's a character. What you gave her a nickname? What did the nickname?
I called her the showgirl because she wears. She looks to me. She has a costume where she's wearing like a white vest and a jacket with big lapels and wears like a little peaked cap and she's to me she looks like a cross between like a 1940s I don't know armed services entertainment woman like we would last would have seen in I guess the first Captain America film where they had the USO dancers yep. on stage with them so she looks like between that and like an usherette. From like the old theater days. So I just thought the showgirl was kind of apt. Maybe yeah. not, but yeah. But yeah, she wears that sort of costume and she has like the old domino eye mask over her eyes. Now, I think she's one character. You came up with a good theory as to why she might be a different character.
Yeah, well, at first we were thinking, is this Crazy Jane? Has she sort of amalgamated her personalities into a new personality? Mm-hmm. But perhaps this is Coagula, we're both thinking.
Mm. Yeah, so that was a very interesting suggestion you brought up because we were just talking about, we were discussing later runs and Rachel Pollack's run came up, including Coagula. And you won quite, you know, within your right to wonder if this character was Coagula. And I would be kind of cool with that if it was.
Mm, yeah, so that's the transgender person that Rachel Pollack introduced in. Yeah,
and she never really had an official costume, I guess. I mean, when we first met her, she kind of puts on a frog mask that covers her entire head,
right?
To give her some sort of secret identity, but that only lasts like an issue and maybe even one fight. So it would be very interesting if this was Coagula.
Mm.
I could still see it being. A new personality of Jane's as well, but I like where your head's at, sir. I like it very much.
Mm.
Should we put a wager on it?
Oh, well, we're both on the same side with this, aren't we?
Well, I'm still leaning more towards Jane.
Okay. All right. I reckon it's Coagula. You reckon it's Jane?
Yep.
What will the winner have to do?
Ooh.
It's a trick. The loser should do something there.
We'll think about it. Oh, we could leave it up to the listeners.
Oh, listeners. If there's any listeners out there.
Yeah.
Tell us what you think.
Let's do that. We'll leave it to the listeners and then we'll pick the most interesting thing. Oh, God.
Tell us your wages. Don't give us your pay slips.
No.
No, you know what I mean. Wager with an R.
Yep.
Yeah. Cool. Oh, we already have a suggestion for Rift. Loser buys the winner a pony.
All right, you're on. All right, let's just stick with that one. Yes, we've had a live wager in from friend of the show and silent partner Rifter. He said, loser buys the winner a pony. Let's do that.
Awesome.
Okay. Because otherwise we'd be waiting for more listener suggestions and they would have probably gotten a little bit weird.
Yeah. Is that ticking, I hear?
It is, thank God. Let's segue over to look at the doom clock. So looking at the face of the doom clock, we can see that the last Doom Patrol book we had was issue 22 of volume 5 from the Giffen Clark run. That was cover dated July 2011 and went on sale May 4th of that same year. So it has been 5 years and 13 weeks since we last had a Doom Patrol book. But issue 1 of volume 6 is only 6 weeks away now. Launches September 14th.
Good golly.
I know. So start saving your pocket money for that one, gang. Because if you don't go out and buy it, I'll be very disappointed in you.
Actually, my parents haven't given me pocket money for quite some time now.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you think you're out a bit of back pay from them?
I better talk to them.
Actually, now that you mention it, yeah. Okay, I have a word with my mum too. God. Anyway, it's been 51 weeks, almost a full year, since we saw the a team appear in two different comics. Those were All-Star Section 8, number 3, and Justice League United, number 12. But this week in Doom Patrol history, going on sale for US $2.99 on August 4th, 2010, and cover dated October 2010, was issue 13 of volume 5 of the Doom Patrol from the Giffen Clark era. And this issue was titled I'm Still Rita, and it gave Rita Farr her own spotlight issue. And it showed us her origins and a bit of her past, as well as how she was dealing with the return of Steve Dayton in the present.
Steve bloody Dayton.
What a jerk. And it's got a really cool cover where she's kind of looking at herself in the mirror, but there's newspaper clippings from her previous Hollywood life all over the mirror as well. Very cool Matthew Clark cover. So, yeah, we haven't got to that one yet, but we will get there one day at some stage. But, yeah, definitely go check that one out if you're looking for a good Rita-centric issue to read. And that's it for the Doom Clock this week.
Justice League International, Bwahaha Podcast, a new monthly show chronicling the adventures of the JLI era by Keith Giffen and J.M. DeMatteis. We'll be going issue by issue, in release order, tackling the core Justice League title, Justice League Europe, and the quarterly book. Along the way, we'll take time out for special episodes covering various spin-offs, cartoon appearances, the infamous TV pilot, and much more. So join me in an ever-changing roster of guest hosts as we celebrate your favorite JLI members, such as
Martian Manhunter,
Batman,
Dr. Fate,
Black Canary,
Fire,
Ice,
Maxwell Lord,
Oberon,
Captain Marvel,
Rocket Red,
Captain Atom,
Mr. Miracle,
Guy Gardner,
Booster Gold,
Blue Beetle,
Nort,
and many, many more. Justice League International, Bwahaha Podcast, coming March 2016 as part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Want to make something of it?
Today on Doomsplaining, we're going back to Volume 1 of the Doom Patrol. We're going to look at issues 113 and 114. So 113, it was cover dated August 1967, but actually came out June 6, 1967. Ah, that's interesting, isn't it?
Mm.
Mm. 12 Cents, edited by Murray Boltanoff, and it contained two stories, and they're both written by Arnold Drake, and they're both drawn by Bruno Premiani. And it had a lovely cover by Bob Brown, not the Green Senator. and it shows a giant green metallic robot-looking man with a machine gun arm and a sword arm. And he's fighting the Doom Patrol, and they're all sort of leaping out of the way of this gunfire. And it says, who dares to challenge the Arsenal? So let's get into it.
The Doom Patrol, that's who dares.
That surely is the case. So in the story entitled Who Dares to Challenge the Arsenal, we see the non-wheelchair-bound members of the Doom Patrol mid-assault on some soldiers in some castle, you know, like they have all over the United States. Negative Man, Larry Trainer, leads the charge in his regular bandage form. He is soon joined by Elastigirl, Rita Farr, and Robot Man, Cliff Steele, who drops from above to knock the crap out of a soldier using his metal crotch. Ow! They are being remotely guided, as always, by the wheelchair band leader of the Doom Patrol, Niles Calder, the chief, who gives them advice by radio and watches them on his giant monitor. It's Betty by time. Larry punches a soldier so hard that he says, Bazoof! The soldiers open fire on the patrol from a machine gun turret on a parapet, which makes Larry say, machine guns! And Cliff say, them ain't no bean shooters. But Rita takes care of it by embiggening her arm to grab a searchlight and smash the turret flat. Well done, Rita.
Well done.
They're here to take down a master criminal. The chief tells Robot Man to keep the camera on his chest on to capture all the action. The camera on Robot Man's chest must be magical, as it gives Chief a view from way ahead that looks back at Robot Man. Weird.
Yep.
Yep. The team soon come face to face with Arsenal. No, not the English football team, the other Arsenal. No, not the Dial H villain, the other Arsenal. No, not the cat-swinging, grown-up, junkie sidekick of Green Arrow, the other Arsenal.
Wow. There's a lot of Arsenals lurking around there.
Yeah, the Arsenal who looks like a green version of the not-as-giant Iron Giant with a blade arm and a machine gun arm.
Right. Okay.
Arsenal, apparently a well-spoken, theatrical man inside the robot, speechifies in a real down-to-earth way. He boasts truest, who boasts finely. But I admire your courage, Doom Patrol, to walk right into this nest of vipers. Now feel my sting!
He's almost like a Mandrake the monster.
Yes.
These horrible enemies that just, you know, are really good at speechifying.
They are. Yeah. Anyway, he fires his machine gun arm, causing Cliff to shout, "Dig that crazy wrist action!" While Master of the Bleeding Obvious, Larry, helpfully exclaims, "He's got a machine gun for one hand!" After ducking under his machete blade arm, which he has on the other arm, Robot Man slams Arsenal in the groin, presumably in the belief that that's the most vulnerable part of a robot, is the junk area. Arsenal responds by breathing fire. And then Larry unleashes Negman finally, but Arsenal shoots out electricity out of his eyes. Electricity, Negative Man's one weakness, apart from lead coffins, alien rays, passage of time, etc.
Don't give it all away. I want to be listening.
Negman innovates and generates heat with his radio energy. This handy new power he suddenly has helps him cut a hole in the floor under Arsenal. Arsenal falls to his doom. No, he doesn't. He activates his feet rockets and breaks out through the wall and flies away with a quick parting comment of, "I was foolish enough to have underestimated you, Doom Patrol, but we will meet again soon, and I will not repeat my mistake." Cliff has no time to stop him, but luckily has time enough to retort, "No, but that time you'll find some new mistake to make."
Oh, stinging.
Nice one, Cliff.
Yeah, well done.
Rita has to run. She's left her arsehole rich husband Steve Dayton at home with her recently adopted ward Gar Logan, Beast Boy, and all hell has broken loose in her absence as Mento and Beast Boy play chess and squabble. Chaos turns to snacking as Steve hits the caviar and mentions his plan to defreakify Gar by hiring a scientist to remove his green pigmentation. Rita arrives just then and tells Steve, "No way, there's only one scientist who's trustworthy, and that's Niles Calder."
Yep, sure is.
So cut to see what trustworthy Niles Calder, the chief, is up to. He's turning on his monitor to watch the hidden camera that he had Robot Man strictly install in Madame Rouge's bedroom. That's Madame Rouge from the Brotherhood of Evil.
Mm-hmm.
And the monitor probably isn't the only thing getting turned on at this point. He's watching Madame Rouge in an attempt to turn her from good to evil. Hidden camera in a wooden bedroom. Nothing creepy about that, Niles.
No, not at all.
Not only does it have a camera, it has a ray treatment that can fire out of the camera, which is behind a painting, so it comes out of the painting's eye, and it's aimed at the schizophrenic centers of her brain. Sounds legit.
Comic book science.
Yes. Anyway, the following day, inside a great bank, the caption tells us, not a crap bank, Arsenal is robbing the joint. Lucky for the guards, he's using his machine gun to swat them aside rather than shoot them. Phew. He trashes the place and escapes the cops. Cliff and Larry knock on Chief's lab door, seeking his advice to stop this crime spree by the Arsenal. But Chief won't come out. "Leave me alone. I have no time to think of petty crooks. My present work is too vital." Yeah, your present work watching Madame Rouge in the bedroom? Yeah, sure.
The sure. Arsenal's not that petty.
Anyway, without the Chief's help, Cliff has asked the computer, and as they do, the computer tells him Arsenal has probably returned to his first hideout, the typical all-American castle.
Yeah.
So having collected Rita and Larry, the trio return to Arsenal's HQ, where they are immediately trapped in a cage that swings up from the ground around them like on four sides, like this pyramid. And as they talk about how to get out, the cage becomes electrified, so no Negman escapes this time.
Mm-hmm.
But Larry comes up with the plans. Cliff should grab the bars and ground the charge while Rita fully embiggens herself to spring the cage apart. And the plan works.
Go team.
Yeah. The three then race off into the heart of the building and, faced with three doors, immediately split up. Nothing can go wrong with that plan.
Nope. Go team.
Robot Man finds his door open onto a pit, and he's quick enough to grab the door. Phew. But then his weight pulls the door off on his hinges. Oh, no.
Whoops.
And Larry finds himself at a dead end. But hang on, this wall sounds hollow, and pushing on this block triggers a trap, and water gushes into the room. Oh, no. For an entire panel, he's in big trouble till he uses Negative Man to carry his body out by busting a hole in the ceiling. Phew.
Thank goodness. Oh. That was a pretty hectic one panel.
Rita's path leads to a narrow tunnel, so naturally she crawls inside as you would. And she ends up inside a hollow metal block, which gets smashed flat by these giant pistons, which we can see on the outside. Uh-oh. Luckily, her elasticity saves her, and she can embiggen the parts of her body that aren't smashed flat and then push the piston apart. Push the piston apart. Phew!
All that and alliteration, my God.
Yeah. Meanwhile, in the Doom Patrol headquarters, Niles emerges from his lab after hours of perving on Madame Rouge. Perhaps he ran out of lotion. Anyway, I don't mean the cat. Anyway, he wonders where the team is and then remembers that they're fighting Arsenal, like they told him they were going to do 5 pages earlier. What an arsehole. But he jumps on the mic to assist the team and manages to help Cliff avoid smashing his body into a movie image of Arsenal. Mm-hmm. And then Reacher reaches from above with a giant hand, pulls the real Arsenal interview so Cliff can smash the crap out of him. And from the broken Arsenal body, a tiny figure emerges, a little person?
A short man.
A short man. Anyway, it's a timely reminder that we should all fear everyone who is different. Right, kids? Anyway.
Yes.
That tiny guy is off to jail. Anyway, mm-hmm. back at the Doom Patrol headquarters, it's cocktail hour for everyone who doesn't have a robot body. Poor Cliff. And the chief is apologizing for his preoccupation. His work is real important, but not so important that he abandons the team to die.
No.
Anyway, speaking of his work, we see Monsieur Mala and the Brain, the other members of the Brotherhood of Evil, and they're talking about how they've overheard Madame Rouge talking in her sleep about becoming good, and thereby becoming an unsuitable candidate for an organization known as the Brotherhood of Evil, I'd say. luckily, they also have surveillance devices in her bedroom.
Uh-oh. This poor woman.
So they start sending a subliminal evil reinforcing messages at the same time as the chief is using his ray to send good messages, and the battle of mind controlling perverts has begun.
Wow.
So, Mike, how does this one hit you?
Well, this one is a lot of fun. It's again another, I guess, one-hit wonder enemy, because this is the only time we ever see the Arsenal. Although he did appear in the Batman Brave and the Bold episode that the Doom Patrol were in.
I have an understanding the Arsenal returns in some way in the comics, actually.
Really?
I do.
Okay, I'm forgetting something or I'm missing something, because I honestly thought this was his only appearance.
No, I think Gar's scumbag guardian actually ends up with the armor at some point.
Oh, okay, yeah, a bit of my brain's firing off now. I think you are correct. Yes.
Okay. Yes. Well,
up until then, I thought this was Arsenal's only appearance. But yeah, it's another cool robot, you know, causing havoc and getting the team to fight. And it's nice how it continues the chief's obsession with Madame Rouge. What did you make of it?
I mean, Arsenal's the motivation of Arsenal is a bit dodgy. I'm a dwarf who wants to show people by destroying the Doom Patrol.
And there are a few enemies that are like that. They just turn up and want to wreak havoc because society's done them wrong. So,
yeah. Yeah. But what a missed opportunity for Giacomo to come back.
Oh, my God, Giacomo. Oh, I'll have to look back through the archives. When was the last time we saw or even mentioned Giacomo?
Giacomo, he only appeared in, like, the really early issues of My Greatest Adventure.
It's not since the Brotherhood formed beneath the private girls' school in France.
Yeah, like he was a master of disguise, disguising himself as a little schoolgirl, if I remember. Anyway, we haven't seen Giacomo, and this would have been a good opportunity for Giacomo to return. But
that's a very good point.
But yeah,
it was a fun story. It had the subplot with Rouge continuing. It had some wacky action with them fighting in this castle in the suburbs.
Yeah.
Which was a bit
strange. A castle. Just one of those lair castles.
Yeah. You know, hey, look, Scooby-Doo found one every week. Why can't these guys? You know?
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a fun issue. A very fun read. And the art's great. And especially some of the shots of Rita as well, like when she's standing up to Steve and kind of holding Gar there and telling that the only trustworthy mad scientist is Niles.
Yeah, there's some good Rita in this. And I really like the design of Arsenal. You know, it looks a little bit like the Iron Giant, but with more weapons on the outside. So,
mm-hmm.
But cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Don't know why he's green, though. That's
I don't know.
Mm. Anyway, there is a backup story here, and it's called The Diamonds of Destiny, and it's we're going to return for a previously untold story of Gar Logan, Beast Boy, and it's an unnecessary story, really. But it's not the story of how he went from being called Craig as he was in his first appearance.
True.
That is an unnecessary untold story that remains untold. Mm. Anyway, this is narrated by Beast Boy, so we get a little recap of his origin. So, contracting a rare skin disease, a disease called Sakusha in deepest, darkest Africa, then given a comic book science monkey serum cure by his jungle scientist parents, Garlu Logan is soon a green-skinned orphan boy with animal-changing powers. Yes. And he only wants to live alone in the trees with his chimpanzee pal, so naturally a local witch doctor sees him as a threat who must die. And then we see some unshaven mercenary types, Kurt and Stokes, on the run from the Jungle Patrol, who are searching the jungle for sacred diamonds. I wonder if the Jungle Patrol is an offshoot of the Doom Patrol.
Could be.
Anyway, the witch doctor sees them and offers a sweet deal. He'll give them the location of the diamonds in exchange for if they murder an orphan. And who wouldn't take that deal?
That's decent pay for a fair day's work.
You know? Sign me up. Anyway, Gar is having a water fight with his chimp pal when a crocodile attacks, and he quickly turns into a green rhino with a human face. And I've been listening to Teen Titans Wasteland, and they did an episode about Gar, and since then I can't unsee this. Gar turns into animals with Donald Trump hair.
Ooh. Wow. Crap, yep. Beast Boy's ruined for me now.
Yeah, you can't unsee that. So a green rhino with Donald Trump here. Anyway, there's a quick rhino-croc fight and Gar is out of danger. And he overhears the witch doctor making the deal with the treasure hunters and follows them to the hidden cave where the sacred diamonds are located. And the witch doctor wants the two to kill the kid now, but they renege and just as green trump-haired bat attacks them. And then it turns into a trump-haired snake and a green trump-haired leopard. But luckily, the mercenary Stokes shoots Gar in the head. Yep. But
probably
fortunately,
for that horrible Trump hair.
Yeah, and he turns back into a green boy, and he's lucky enough to be shot in the head in such a way as to just be stunned and not dead. So that's lucky.
Very lucky.
And Stokes, recognizing the profitability in having a boy who can turn into green animals with Donald Trump hair, convinces Kurt to grab his body and carry him out of the cave just as it collapses, as caves do in these sort of circumstances.
Mm.
And outside, there's the tribe. They've gathered at the noise, and they see the men flee with Gar's unconscious form. And at the same time, a certain scumbag, Nicholas Galtry, arrives by boat in Africa to collect his ticket to riches, which is the form of his boy he's been made guardian of, and the fortune that Gar has inherited. And it is to be continued, this story.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. So what do you think of this filler?
It's not bad. It's okay. It's action packed. It's Beast Boy has officially been ruined for me now, though. So thank you to who was it? Teen Titans Wasteland.
Teen Titans Wasteland. Yep.
Thank you to Teen Titans Wasteland for ruining Beast Boy in the 60s for me. Yay!
Hey.
But the thing is, they're not wrong though.
No,
it does look like that. Wow.
Yeah.
But overall, yeah, the backup story, it's fine. The main story is a lot of fun and great, you know, action-packed adventure for the team there. And Beast Boy's backup story, it's fine. It's good fun.
Yeah, it's continuing in the tradition of expanding on really simple origins that work with more detail that don't really help, I think.
Yeah, I'm still annoyed that Cliff and Negative Man both got background stories of what happened with them before they joined the team, and Rita didn't.
No, Rita.
They instead gave Gar Logan the spotlight for the backup fill-up stories, which is, it's fine. Yeah. I'm sure he was really popular with the kids back in the day.
Yeah, that's not fair.
It's not. He's not even a proper member of the team.
Yeah. He's
some punk-ass green kid with Donald Trump hair.
Yeah, it's going to be more popular than all of them. The green kid, not Donald Trump.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, shall we move on to the next of these two?
Let's do it. The next one is issue 114 with a cover date of September 1967, but actually went on sale July 20th, 1967 for a mere 12 cents. Again, edited by Murray Boltonoff, with words by Arnold Drake, art by Brenno Premiani, and the cover by Bob Brown.
Not the Green Senator. Yeah. Got to keep clarifying that message.
Yeah, just for all our Australian listeners. Yeah, because I'm sure. Anyway, the cover shows us a gigantic looking caveman who's wearing a lab coat and has a fancy sci-fi weapon pointed at the team at his feet, and it yells, "Genius turns caveman, the whole world quakes before Kaw the Conqueror."
Kaw.
He's a conqueror. Kaw, blimey. As we open the issue, we see that a time barrier has formed in the middle of the city. A huge Neanderthal emerges carrying this high-tech weapon of some sort, and Larry Traynor explains it can only be Professor Koravik who created that weapon. And the patrol rushes in to attack, with Larry warning them they don't know what the weapon actually does. And Cliff replies that the caveman doesn't know what it does either, because he's swinging it like a Stone Age baseball bat. Oh dear. The patrol realizes that the time barrier behind them is still open, and now a woolly mammoth has come through it. So good old Rita embiggens herself to deal with it, and she begins to subdue the mammoth by, looks like she's trying to hogtie it. As you do. But the mammoth gets the leg free and manages to kick her in the head.
Ow.
Ow. So it's up to Eggman to save the day. He defeats the mammoth with an energy blast, but they realize that Dr. Koravik has escaped during the chaos. And elsewhere, this giant Neanderthal has figured out how to actually activate the weapon he was carrying, and he begins destroying every building in sight.
Zack Snyder style.
Wow. So you're watching saying is you want Zack Snyder presents the Doom Patrol film. God. Hi, Zack, if you're listening. Later, at Doom Patrol headquarters, the team meet Governor Driscoll, who wants answers from the chief about how a caveman with an earthquake machine can destroy a square city block. And the chief explains that Dr. Anton Koravik was an expert in sonic vibrations, and that he and Anton even worked on a top-secret sonar project during World War II. But that was the last time Chief saw Koravik until he arrived at Chief's lab earlier that evening, saying he was tired of making weapons for his government and he wanted the chief's help to get away. But Koravik was clearly paranoid that his genius would continue to be used by his government for evil purposes. And even though Chief tried to tell him that he would be safe here in America, Anton didn't believe him and refused to take his word that he'd be safe with the patrol. And he stormed off to where else but a nearby university lab, because they're always just so close. And the patrol tracks him down there later on, just as he's standing in front of a giant device that blasts him and blows up the lab and traps our heroes in some sort of energy dome.
Yeah, weird.
Yeah, not good. The negative being manages to tear a hole in this dome of energy, which allows the rest of the team to escape. And because Cliff was the least affected, because his human brain is encased in the robot body, he decides to investigate further to see exactly what it is that Koravik has created. And he discovers himself back in the Stone Age, or so he thinks he's gone back in the Stone Age in time. And he witnesses a saber-toothed tiger fighting a... I'm not going to call it a dinosaur because it's the least realistic dinosaur I've ever seen.
It's a bit lizardy.
Yeah, it's a saber-toothed tiger fighting a giant lizard thing.
Yeah.
Let's go with that.
Could be a monitor.
Giant monitor.
A giant monitor.
Because we love giant monitors in classic Doom Patrol, yes. Okay, so saber-toothed tiger is fighting a giant monitor lizard.
Yes.
And shocked at this discovery, the team reports back to the chief, who realizes that Koravik meant escaping to the past so that he couldn't be found in the present. But his hasty experiment has failed to actually send him back in time and instead turned the area and everyone around him into their primitive counterparts.
Sure.
So it's not actually a gateway to the past. It's everything's been de-evolved.
Sure.
Is that the correct comic book science term?
I think so. I don't know.
Let's run with that. Look, if we can have giant monitor lizards.
I'm sure the science all holds up if you run it properly.
Yeah. Upon hearing this news, Governor Driscoll, who is somehow still at Doom Patrol headquarters at this stage, he gets fed up and he gives the team 1 hour to save Kravik, and after that, he must die.
Yeah, why not?
Why not? Because, you know, he destroyed a city block, so he must die for that affront to the governor's goodwill. We cut away to see Kor facing off against 3 army tanks, and they fire upon him, but he activates his sonic weapon and it destroys the missiles and the tanks themselves. And Kor's going on a rampage, and he roars that he must become the big chief of all the lands. And he turns his weapon on City Hall and destroys that as well. So it's getting even more and more Snyder-esque. And at this point, the patrol arrives, and Kor uses the weapon on Robot Man, who has all but one of his limbs vibrated off his body. Do we get to take a drink, Paul?
Right, we take a drink, yep.
Take a drink, cool. He's still got one limb attached. So half a drink, With a huge effort, Cliff uses his last attached limb to bend the sonic weapon until it breaks, causing an explosion, causing Kor to run off back to the time barrier, most likely to look for another one of these weapons, they assume. And after some quick repairs to Cliff back at the headquarters, they hit the road again and track down Kor. And suddenly he's been knocked out by a mammoth in the time portal, giving them the perfect chance to go back to the lab ruins where they last saw the Doctor in his normal form, reactivate his time machine, which somehow survived the explosion, and they thankfully revert Kor back into Dr. Kravik himself. Right.
Yeah.
Good. Because Dr. Anton, he thanks them for saving him, and he vows to try to see if he can live and work in peace, to which the chief replies, "You will, and your work will repay the world 10 times over for the destruction of this day." And the final scene shows Chief alone in his lab once again, preparing to give Madame Rouge her final treatment, if you'll pardon the innuendo, getting her to leave the Brotherhood of Evil forever and help the patrol to destroy them.
Yeah,
what did you think of that one, Paul?
This one is a little fast and loose with the science, I'm suspecting.
Yeah.
A bit, you know, even for a Doom Patrol comic, the science in this one is a bit inaccurate, I would say.
A little bit. I'm a big fan of comic book science, but even this one is testing my limits with that. The other thing, there seems to be, I'm not going to explain it properly or clearly, I just know, but there's something about the way the story progresses that doesn't gel right with me either.
There are leaps of logic in it that, presumably other people got devolved into lizards and saber-toothed tigers?
That as well, but the scene where the team... the opening of the story, we're halfway into the action where the team meet and fight Kor the Neanderthal with the sonic weapon. The team go back to the headquarters, they meet the governor, and it's at this point where Chief is relaying the story to the governor of how Dr. Anton Karevic suddenly turned up and wanted asylum, for want of a better word, but his paranoia got the better of him, so he took off. And then it seems like a good chunk of the remainder of the story is stuck in that past tense.
Yeah.
And doesn't quite...
Where does it catch up with the start? Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And that kind of made the story not as enjoyable for me as well. If someone wants to write into the show and tell me what it is I'm missing, or if they have a better explanation for it than that, please by all means get in touch, because... That kind of, the story didn't flow and didn't make sense for me in that respect.
Yeah, but maybe we need to look at this through the lens of the juvenile brain. So, I mean, if you got this comic as a young lad, you'd see like a caveman with an earthquake gun fighting tanks, and it's got dinosaurs and saber-tooths. It's just rad.
Yeah, or giant lizards and saber-tooths.
Yeah, giant lizards, yes, would be correct. Yeah.
Well, yes, you're right. I could be overanalyzing it because, yes, this was, you know, meant to be fun and daring do and, you know, weird heroes fighting weird enemies. And I could be looking far too much into it, but it just... I think the Arsenal story was more enjoyable for me than the core one was. It just seemed a bit far-fetched.
Yeah, some of the motivation of this scientist is a little bit... It's like, I don't want to be involved. I'm going to go back in time. What? Yeah.
Yeah.
Why don't you go retire?
Yeah, why not? End of the story.
Go live in Australia.
Yeah.
Where no one in comics ever went in the 60s.
That's right. We didn't exist till, you know... Oh, God. When was the invasion storyline? The 80s?
Yeah, 88.
Yeah. Oh, just in time for the bicentenary.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah. I semi-rate this. I mean, it's got some... I mean, I think it has some crazy cool stuff, but it doesn't make a lick of sense.
No. Which is fine. You know, it is the Doom Patrol, and we've just seen a shit ton of weirdness from Morrison in more recent times. But, yeah, this was... Yeah, it was okay. It was okay. There is also a backup story, or as we call it, filler, that continues on the origins of Beast Boy in a story called The Kid Who Was the King of Crooks. And just very briefly, Beast Boy, who was kidnapped by the Diamond Thieves, he's now been taken to Johannesburg, and they've decided that they're going to get Gar to rob a diamond vault for them using his abilities. So he sneaks in various forms of animals. And despite the first attempt also almost getting them caught afterwards, they fool the police that are looking for who may have robbed the vault, and they soon get Gar to break into a gold works for them. So they're onto bigger and better things very quickly. Things take a turn for the worse when Gar decides to make a game of hiding the gold bars he stole, but his captors turn on each other, each of them thinking that their partner has taken the gold for themselves. So each of the men end up shooting them each other dead right in front of young Gar. So the story ends with poor Gar being, orphaned once again, or all on his own once again on the streets of Johannesburg. Meanwhile, Nicholas Galtry is getting even closer to tracking down the boy for himself.
Mm.
Yeah. It's kind of... That kid had a shitty upbringing.
Things did not go Gar's way for quite some time.
No. And some of his speech as well in these stories, it's like, I don't know whether Premiani never heard a child talk.
It's sort of like Bizarro speak, except it's not negative. It's the saying things the right way, but it's that sort of cadence and those sorts of words. So me never figured he think that so soon. What fun, and things like that.
It's almost like he went to caveman school. I don't get it. So, but it's an okay story. I think this combined with the core story, it's an okay issue. You know, I do think the one with the Arsenal story is still better of the two. But you know, it's still 60s Doom Patrol. I still love it, no matter what. Just Arsenal was slightly more exciting, and I can't believe I'm going to say this about a Doom Patrol story. Slightly more believable.
Yeah, well, there's definitely less creepy chief in this one.
Well, that's in its favour too. Yes, although it ends with him saying, "Oh, I'm gonna give her a final treatment, and you know, make her good even faster."
Mm.
And I still have issues with that whole zapping someone's brain to make them either good or evil. You know?
Because
schizophrenia is such an easy dial to change.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. God. Turn it off. Turn it on. Turn it off. Yeah.
Yeah. That was some okay issues. Yeah. Hmm. They make a refreshing change after Morrison doses.
Yes. So we've doomsplained them?
We sure have.
Okay.
Superman, Blue Beetle, Captain Marvel, Firestorm, The Crimson Avenger, Batman, Halo, Guy Gardner, The Sandman, Shadow Lass, Doll Man, The Star Spangled Kid, The Flash, The Phantom Stranger, Power Girl, Hawkman, Fury, The Challengers of the Unknown, Nightwing, The Whip, Johnny Thunder, The Suicide Squad, Deadman, The Spectre, Warlord, Amazing Man, Hourman, Adam Strange, Dr. Occult, The Doom Patrol, Captain Comet, Creep, Green Lantern, Uncle Sam, The Guardian, Batgirl, Dr. Mid-Jonah Hex, Black Comet, The Manhunters, The Guardians of the Floronic, Blue Devil, Dr. Fate, The Legion of Super, The Secret Origins Podcast, covering every issue of DC's Secret Origins comic from the 1980s. Hosted by Ryan Daly and a multitude of guests from the podcast and blogging community. Secret Origins Podcast. Find it on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and at fireandwaterpodcast.com.
Time for the Mailbag of Doom. And firstly, we got an email from Arbad. And he said, "Dear Mike and Paul, since you asked for feedback on the last episode, which we did, I certainly do not share your lack of enthusiasm for this run of the Doom Patrol. In fact, issue 50 of Morrison's run is one of my favorite DP moments.
Ooh.
When you go, 'It is confusing. Oh, Morrison, meh,' I would go, 'Oh, I don't really get it at all, but it's great.' For me, the book works best when the Patrol is not portrayed as a regular supergroup. I concede the storytelling is far from clear. Bear in mind that when I was reading it when it was first coming out, before the cult status, let's say, I had no knowledge about the 60s run apart from the odd review mentioning that the original members were killed in action. It was way weird but captivating. But on a second or third read, you see that they lose pages or random panes fit into a larger narrative. And in a scene like the introduction of Number None, which feels lost in the middle of another storyline, but it eventually fits somewhere. More than that, you can trace a long-term arc from issues 18 to 63 dealing with Cliff's role in Jane's path to sanity and the issues of questioning conformity along the way, and there was a plan after all. And I love that based on a true story Albert Hoffman tale and the second incarnation of the Brotherhood of Dada, they beat the Tomb Patrol first and then they won their support in the end, and they managed to make the Patrol think about its place in the world and question what they were really fighting for. Is it all worth it? It all led to the final Morrison arc, and it helps inform each of the characters' reactions later. And maybe if you'd covered issues 49 and 50 together with 51 and 52, it would make more sense, for the lack of a better word. Anyway, the Comics Should Be Good blog had a more better articulated take on this than me, and he gave us a link to the Comics Should Be Good where they talks about the entire Grant Morrison run. And all the best, and keep going. Thank you for that encouragement. So,
thank
Mike,
you.
How do you take that criticism?
I think that's more than fair. I think different people are going to read and take different things from Morrison's run completely, just with any other run. So, but I do think he makes some interesting points about you know, the patrol do work better when they're not being standard superheroes. You know, when they're facing the stranger stuff, and you know, they're the only ones that can kind of deal with it. I do like the fact that Abad brought up Cliff's role in Jane's path and in her character arc as well, because I think that's a very important relationship in the storyline. And he's right, the questioning of conformity along the way, that's always been a big part of Morrison's stuff. So I think he makes some good points, and you know, maybe if we had covered those four issues closer together, we'd be thinking differently. But you know, I think there's some good points about there. How about you? What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, I think we're kind of trapped by the format that we approach these in, is like we read a couple, then we stop and talk about them. Whereas, you know, if you were reading this, you would just read through and you'd keep going, or, you know, have a break when you're tired. But, yeah, having to articulate your feelings about it, you know, if you were just reading it, you'd probably just wash over you and sort of build up a complete narrative. But, you know, we do a podcast where we have to chat about it, so we have to chat about it. So, yeah, and some of them, you know, it's sometimes it's quite hard to talk about the Morrison run and not feel like you're an idiot, you know?
True, yeah. I've said before, you know, myself, I'm sure there's stuff that I'm missing or I'm not getting, because you so often see people go, "Oh, Morrison stuff, it's genius, it's great, it's so in-depth," and you've missed this stuff, and it's like, oh, okay, sure.
Yeah. And I mean, I was probably a little harsh when I was talking about the pinups at the back, and you know that, and I, you know, I may be completely wrong. I mean, these artists might have submitted the art they wanted to, and then Grant Morrison put captions on it. I mean, that could have worked that way. We got no idea, really. So, you know, but yeah, I was probably a little rough on it last week, but
again, that's your opinion of it, and that's just because you don't enjoy something that someone else might, doesn't mean your opinion is any less valid, though, Paul.
So. Yeah, but I mean, there is a, this definitely is a patch of Grant Morrison's run that I, there's probably about a dozen issues where I, my interest in it, my being riveted fades a bit, and but it comes back so strong in just a few issues. So, you know, we've got that to look forward to. And, you know, I, as a run, it is a very good complete whole, and you see that better when you look at it holistically rather than piece by piece like we are. Yeah.
Because, you have to remember, we're covering all the eras of the Doom Patrol, and we're trying to, I guess we jump between, like, last week we did Morrison, this week we're doing the 60s, next week we'll be doing something different again, which we'll get to, which I'm very excited about. But, yeah, it's kind of hard to, I don't think you and I, Paul, would enjoy doing the show if one episode was dedicated to, like, an entire arc. Of any given story, you know, especially Morrison's, you know, that that'd be like, what, a 3-hour episode?
Yeah, and I remember when we started, we very comfortably fell into the idea of let's jump around. Like, it just made it easier to do, and you know, we get variety and we get to change gears, you know, every week.
Yeah, and I think it shows that Morrison's run, as good as it is for the majority of it, in my opinion, it's not the be-all and end-all of the patrol. There's some stuff where, you know, in the 80s, they've interacted more with the rest of the DCU when they've met Supergirl and Power Girl and when they've interacted with the Justice League. And then there's stuff in the 60s where it's a bit more silly. There's stuff in the 90s where it got a bit darker and a bit more serious. So, yeah, there's so much to the patrol that, you know, we want to cover it all. So,
Yeah. So, but fair point, Zarbat. And, you know, please don't think we don't like Grant Morrison's run. We do.
We do.
Yeah. It's just some of it's a bit heavier than others and the heavy going. And, you know, it's like the 60s stuff, you can make fun of it pretty easily while you're enjoying it. Whereas the Grant Morrison stuff is, you know, it's a bit hard to get a handle on to talk about it sometimes.
I think every incarnation of them has its faults, and I still love the patrol. I mean, like the storyline where it was in the New Teen Titans where they were hunting down the killers of the patrol. My God, that was wordy.
Yeah,
so many words in that in, you know, one page alone was like a freaking thesaurus.
Yeah,
but it was still an okay story. So yeah, I think we're quite happy to pick apart something we love. You know?
Yeah.
But thank you, Albert. I do appreciate you writing it.
Yeah, and thank you for the encouragement to keep going, because we are going to keep going. We're going to go all the way.
Ooh, hello. Sorry.
Okay. Now, we had a question of the week, and we were asking people, what's your favourite fictional family? We heard from Martin Gray, who said, wish that the favourite fictional funny book family for Focus, so he wanted to concentrate on comics. You can do that, Martin Gray. You can answer the question any way you want.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, he came back and he said, it has to be the Bruins, and not just for their link to Flex Mentallo, Man of Muscle Mystery. And he gave us a link to the Bruins comic that I've never heard of.
Well, it seems to be a Scottish thing primarily.
Oh, no wonder.
And it's been around since 1936. It's like a Sunday comic strip sort of thing. So
it's a fad, what you're saying?
It's a short-lived fad about the Bruin family, yes. So an apologies to Mark for my horrible Scottish accent.
Bit of a brogue there.
Bit of a brogue. It's about the Bruin family who put in and live in a flat on 10 Glebe Street. God, that's a horrible accent. In the fictional town of Auchentogle or Auchenschlugel? I've probably just mangled that as well. I should really stop.
Don't mangle your Auchenschlugel.
Well, you did say we were going to go all the way.
Wow. And we heard from Schmuckenfuss, who's at Rack and Ruin.
Mm-hmm.
They said the Umbrella Academy, it's not happy at times. They insist they don't love each other, but there's a deep affection in the writing. Yeah, that is a good family. It's a sort of pulled together family, a bit like the Doom Patrol.
I was wondering if reading that answer, whether the Umbrella was a family like the Richards family in the Fantastic Four, for example. But they're more of a team then?
Yeah, it's not a genetic family, but right. It's people in the similar circumstance with the same upbringing. So.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. But I'm a very good Jared Way comic. Very good. I highly recommend it.
Okay. We also heard from Ferocious Fractures at Fractures, and his answer was The Locks from Lock and Key.
Let's move on before you say you don't like it again.
Look, to be fair, I've only read the first volume and it didn't grab me, so why continue on?
And we heard from FKA Jason from the Silver and Gold podcast and DC vs. Marvel, and he said, knee-jerk reaction answer is the Addams Family. Good answer. But he said real answer is Walter White's dysfunctional crew from Breaking Bad. That's an interesting way to look at it.
Yeah, God.
Yeah.
Then FKA Jason wanted to change his answer. And he said his actual favorite fictional family are the McFlys from Back to the Future. My wife says she likes J.D. Salinger's Glass family.
Well, that's a very intellectual answer.
Okay.
Unfamiliar with that.
Sure someone will let us know.
Anyway. Bye. Cool. Are you ready for an answer to this question, Mike?
I'll let you answer first because I think you've got one prepared better than I have.
Okay, comic books. I think Blue Beetle's family, Jaime Reyes' family, was fantastic in that comic.
Right.
Came out of Infinite Crisis. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the other family I thought of, I don't know if they're the best, but they were pretty watchable. It's the Walshes from 90210. So just let me lose all my cred in one go.
Wow. So you were a 90210 fan then?
I lived with a 90210 fan. I still live with a 90210 fan.
Right.
As often happens, these things rub off on you.
Okay. Right. So what was it about the Walsh family?
I just like the interaction of this, you know, Brenda and Brandon and... the dad and all that, and compared to most of the families in that show, they were the best.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
They were very welcoming of people, I noticed.
This is true, yeah. Okay, sure.
But only at certain holiday times of the year, generally.
Wow, okay. Okay, I've had a bit of a think, and I'm going to give two answers for mine, and... hopefully my TV answer will restore some of your cred, Paul. That's how good it is. But my favorite comic family, and this is a bit of an obscure one, I'm going to have to say the Falconer family from a comic series called Leave It to Chance.
Oh, yeah.
Which was written by one of your favorites, James Robinson.
Yeah.
It only went for 13 issues back in 96 to 99 from Image Comics. And it's a story of a 14-year-old girl named Chance Falconer, who's the son of a famed paranormal investigator called Lucas Falconer. And just the relationship between the father and the daughter in that is one of my favorite things about that series. She's very brave and adventurous is not scared of very much. You know, she's got quite a curious mind, but her father, in his very stern manner, wants to protect her from that life that he's led as a, you know, defender of normal people from monsters in the night sort of thing. So I really like that. I wish it had gone longer than it did. So
it ended with a cliffhanger that was unresolved.
I hate that shit.
Yeah. And I had a letter in it.
I had a letter in it too.
What? We letter buddies.
Oh, I wonder if we're in the same issue.
We're not.
Oh, shit. As for my TV one, and this is, I can't believe I'm going to reveal this because it's a bit of a guilty pleasure and I'm not like a full-on fan of this show.
You're going to say the Kardashians.
No, oh God, no. Kill me now. But it's one of those shows that if it's on TV... I have to sit and watch the episode no matter what else I'm doing. Okay. The show is called Seventh Heaven.
Oh!
And it's about the Camden family. And I don't know what it is about that dorky, cheesy show, but I love the family in that show.
Yeah.
And it's right. It's he the father's a priest, and you know they're very religious, and I'm not a particularly religious person, but there's something about that family and that show that when it's on, it's like, oh, okay, I'll eat my lunch watching that show. Oh, okay, I'll you know do my laundry while I watch that. I can't. And here's the thing. I went to a Star Trek convention a couple of years ago, and I got to meet Catherine Hicks, who was in Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, as Dr. Gillian Taylor. She was the woman that was a whale specialist.
Right.
Right, okay, you clearly haven't seen it. Anyway, I got up to her table and got her to autograph a picture and had a chat with her, and I got very nervous and awkward about explaining how much I enjoyed Seventh Heaven because I just thought it was such a lovely, decent, family-oriented show. And she was very touched by that and was very kind, and we had a very nice conversation about it.
Oh, dear. I've never heard of that show with Jessica Biel in it that my wife watches all the time.
Right. Yeah, I haven't heard of it. Good. Okay. But yeah, I can't. So I think your cred is intact.
Oh, I don't know.
Look, I think you know, a show about cool teens hanging out in Beverly Hills is not quite as dorky as, you know, a cheesy, you know, large, happy family, you know.
Wow. Oh, okay. We should move on.
Yeah. I used to be so cool.
I have seen Star Trek 4.
Right. Okay. Very good. Anyway, I think we've done enough to damage our own reputations there. So we're going to sign off. If you want to get in touch with us, you can also always contact Wilfred on Twitter, who's at WFDpod. You can always email us at waitingfordoom@gmail.com, even if it's to criticize us or, you know, argue a different point of view on something we've discussed, like Arbud did. By all means, we would love to hear from you. Please get in touch. You can also follow mygreatestadventure80.blogspot.com for more Doom Patrol-related shenanigans, thanks to friend of the show, Doug Zavisha, and he'll be giving links and images from the issues we discuss in this episode as well. And so, Paul, next week, what are we talking in terms of Doom Patrol?
What is more exciting than a Doom Patrol number one and a number two?
Not much.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about. So we have finished the Paul Kupperberg run. So we have a little opening in our schedule, and we're going to slot in Doom Patrol Volume 3, which was done by John Arcudi and Tannen Hewitt.
Excellent.
So, and this is a real fresh take on the Doom Patrol. That it's if you don't so know cool. it's very exciting and has some of the best covers of any Doom Patrol.
Oh. Best covers, best action. It's it's got its own unique flavor. Oh, I'm really excited. Oh,
new Doom Patrollers, new characters being introduced. And very excited to see if Jared Way picks up any of this run and runs with it.
That will be interesting.
And we are also asking you the question of the week, which is, what is the best accessory featured in comics?
So you're talking as in an accessory that a character in a comic would use?
Yes, that is how I am talking.
Right, okay.
So, and you can run with your own leeway. Like if you want to say the Fortress of Solitude, you can say that. If you want to say the Batmobile, you can say that. You can say things like that.
Okay, sure.
Giant seahorse.
a giant stone castle in the middle of your suburb.
Yeah. Whatever you like, as long as it's something that we want to talk about.
An accessory of some sort.
Yeah, right. That's right.
Cool.
So, join us next week for that.
Yes. Thanks for joining us again this week, guys. We'll talk to you again next week for more Waiting for Doom.
Bye.